What an odd thing it is to see an entire species, billions of people, playing with, listening to, meaningless tonal patterns, occupied and preoccupied for much of their time by what they call music. This, at least, was one of the things about human beings that puzzled the highly cerebral alien beings, the overlords, in Arthur C. Clarke's novel Childhood's End. Curiosity brings them down to the Earth's surface to attend a concert. They listen politely and at the end congratulate the composer on his great ingenuity, while still finding the entire business unintelligible. They cannot think what goes on in human beings when they make or listen to music, because nothing goes on with them. They themselves, as a species, lack music. We may imagine the overlords ruminating further back in their spaceships. This thing called music, they would have to concede, is in some way efficacious to humans, central to human life. Yet it has no concepts, makes no propositions. It lacks images, symbols, the stuff of language. It has no power of representation. It has no necessary relation to the world. There are rare humans who, like the overlords, may lack the neural apparatus for appreciating tones or melodies. But for virtually all of us, music has great power, whether or not we seek it out or think of ourselves as particularly musical. This propensity to music shows itself in infancy, is manifest and central in every culture, and probably goes back to the very beginnings of our species. Such musicophilia is a given in human nature. It may be developed or shaped by the cultures we live in, by the circumstances of life, or by the particular gifts or weaknesses we have as individuals. But it lies so deep in human nature that one must think of it as innate, much as E.O. Wilson regards biophilia, our feeling for living things. Perhaps musicophilia is a form of biophilia, since music itself feels almost like a living thing. We humans are a musical species, no less than a linguistic one. This takes many different forms. All of us, with very few exceptions, can perceive music, perceive tones, timbre, pitch intervals, melodic contours, harmony, and perhaps most elementally, rhythm. We integrate all of these and construct music in our minds using many different parts of the brain. And to this largely unconscious structural appreciation of music is added an often intense and profound emotional reaction to music. The inexpressible depth of music, Schopenhauer wrote, so easy to understand and yet so inexplicable, is due to the fact that it reproduces all the emotions of our innermost being, but entirely without reality and remote from its pain. Music expresses only the quintessence of life and of its events, never these themselves. Listening to music is not just auditory and emotional, it's motoric as well. We listen to music with our muscles, as Nietzsche wrote. We keep time to music involuntarily, even if we are not consciously attending to it, and our faces and postures mirror the narrative of the melody and the thoughts and feelings it provokes. Much that occurs during the perception of music can also occur when music is played in the mind. The imagining of music, even in relatively non-musical people, tends to be remarkably faithful, not only to the tune and feeling of the original, but to its pitch and tempo. Underlying this is the extraordinary tenacity of musical memory, so that much of what is heard during one's early years may be engraved on the brain for the rest of one's life. Our auditory systems, our nervous systems, are indeed exquisitely tuned for music. How much this is due to the intrinsic characteristics of music itself, its complex sonic patterns woven in time, its logic, its momentum, its unbreakable sequences, its insistent rhythms and repetitions, the mysterious way in which it embodies emotion and will, and how much to special resonances, synchronizations, oscillations, mutual excitations or feedbacks in the immensely complex multi-level neural circuitry that underlies musical perception and replay, we do not yet know.